Hi, welcome back to Winged and Ready. I am once again sitting in the UBS On Air studio in New York City. Very grateful to be here with my guest, Natalie McVeigh. She is a family business advisor, and her expertise runs deep. I have a feeling this podcast could go on for a very long time, so I'm going to be prudent and time us. But Natalie, why don't you take a minute and introduce yourself before we launch into our conversation?
Sure. Thanks, Diane, for having me. I've been working with family offices and family businesses for, you know, just shy of 20 years now. My background is a mix of organizational design, management consulting, and neuroscience and coaching to really help keep the emotional and economic conversations parallel.
Keeping social and economic conversations parallel. From my side of the table, that sounds like a Herculean effort and nearly an impossible task. So good job, security.
For sure.
You must be working around the clock. Give us an example of what that means.
Yeah. So families who own businesses or families who own investments love to be family. They enjoy each other. They have fun on the holidays. But when you add that structure in, whether it's the family office or the family business that has rules and roles, there starts to become behavior that's seen as acceptable or not acceptable. Mm-hmm. And so you have this really tolerant system mixed with a system that's more rigid. Mm-hmm. And for each of us, to your point, when you mentioned the Herculean conversation that comes from doing this, is some of us, it's easier to talk about the money,
yeah,
or pay, but we don't really want to talk about fairness or love or time. Mm-hmm. And so it's really making sure that we acknowledge both of those things at the same time. You know, that fight of who gets the picture over the mantle when mom or dad passes away. It's never that it's a Matisse, right? It's right. Never that it's actual value. And so it's surfacing both and giving both the justice to really get to the root of the issue.
Yeah. And as you deal with families that are multi-generational, do you find that the complexity increases, or is there ever that it's so multi-generational it's baked in as something that they grew up with and they know?
Yeah, that's a funny question. You know, what we see if there's like emotional cutoff or conflict, reconciliation is easier to skip a generation. So if you and I are sisters and we fight, likely our kids will have a better chance of reconciling than the two of us. Not that we couldn't do it, but we might not be willing to have the work. But you're right. There is, you know, humans are starting to have epigenetic markers, which is saying that we pass things from generation to generation. Shame is one of those things. And it's really important to notice that when you're talking about money. Mm-hmm. Everyone really worries of entitlement. I mm-hmm. really worry about shame. Happiness is one of those things that are encoded. But because half of our genes we're born with and half we get to change over time, we don't have to be driven by that past. We can change it. So the long answer that I just gave is yes, and we can still do something about it.
It's so fascinating that you brought up shame and attachment to money, and when you have a family that either has their own family office or their own business, it has to be incredibly, incredibly entwined.
It is. You know, we've all heard about the heirs who are entitled, right? Who are spending too much, who are acting like jerks. In fact, that gets way too much airtime. What I see now is there are heirs that are under this shadow of amazing founder parents who they may never out-earn, who don't feel like this is their money, who feel shame with the wealth inequities that exist today. So it doesn't really matter what side of the coin you are on this conversation. It isn't that money is absent from these feelings. They're very much there. And when we talk about, you know, problematic behaviors like entitlement, it adds more to that layer of shame. You'll have people who are saying, am I entitled?
Right.
Well, the good thing is if you're asking that question, maybe you aren't. It's kind of like if you ask if you're a narcissist, maybe you're not. But we have to be careful about the words we use with the people in these communities.
Yeah. And I would imagine, too, that often people are trying to prove themselves outside and away from either the family wealth or the family business, while that could be admirable, it could cause further angst or disruption or turmoil within the business side of the family structure.
It's true. I have a lot of clients in manufacturing and distribution, and they're not sexy industries, right? Trucking or, you know, packaging or moving, whatever else. And so what I've seen is a lot of heirs actually do go to Harvard or Princeton or whatever, and then they end up in New York in PE or VC, and then they have some knowledge about what their family company's actually doing. The company that used to be $1 million, that's now $250 million or $500 million, and they realize it's a really sound investment. Mm. And they come back. And so it is interesting when you're saying, I want to outpace my parents. Yeah. When your parents have created something really incredible, that might not be the most effective pursuit. Now, in all the cases that I have where, you know, on average, heirs come back at 45, where they've boomeranged back into their family business, they do so with a greater appreciation. So I'm not saying you shouldn't try to go outside. It's that you may be able to make an impact and be successful while you're in the family company as well.
Yeah. And looking at it through a different lens, what that family company means.
Absolutely. The investment that it is, the return on investment, you know, that's what one of my clients told me after being, I think it was 5 years in the city. He was like, when I really sat down and looked at Dad's business, we would have been lucky if we could have acquired that in our portfolio. So why was I looking at it as so uninteresting?
Yeah. I want to go on a little bit of a sidebar tangent, acquiring it into the portfolio. There must be a whole nother hornet's nest when it comes to exiting a family business.
Yeah, exiting or growing, right? I mentioned that a lot of clients are in manufacturing and other industries. So that client and five other of my clients that have very similar examples are acquiring other businesses. Mm-hmm. They're staying a larger platform mm-hmm. in family business. But I have another half dozen clients that are actually, you know, selling to private equity or another strategic buyer because of those acquisitions going on. And, you know, the Business Exit Institute says 70% of family business owners regret the sale of their business.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Say that stat again.
70% of family business owners regret the sale of their business.
That's crazy.
And surprisingly enough, it's not the money. It's not usually purchase price. It's making sure that their values are transferred over. It's making sure that the thing that has their name still stands for what matters. And so whether my clients are finding a match that they're acquiring to build their platform, or whether they're deciding to join another platform, it is those qualitative pieces that are as important as the quantitative piece. In fact, I've had a couple clients create ESOPs or sell mm-hmm. to long-term managers in their company. And when they do that, they take a little less money, or they finance it, they get money later. And so it isn't just the purchase price.
Right. I have to do a little bit of a plug for both of us. As a financial advisor and somebody who works a lot with business owners planning exits, I want all the listeners to know out there that Natalie is actually one of my professional resources that I go to. It is such a fascinating thing to think about, the qualitative. People often attach money only to quantitative.
It's true. You know, the biggest roadblock to actually selling your company is clients tend to overestimate the value of their company. It's not to say that clients haven't gotten great deals. I've been pleased to work with my clients to get 8 to 11, sometimes 12x their business.
Incredible.
But it's really because they've worked really hard. They've built that bench strength. You know, when you're thinking your company's worth a lot, it's because you put your blood, sweat, and tears in it. And the challenge for a lot of clients when they start this conversation about sales, sometimes it's a company that's just them, and they're too late in their career to mm-hmm. want to do it. And that's where the value falls. And so when we work together, you know, Diane and I often talk about the timeliness of the sale mm-hmm. and what we need to do to make sure that, yes, we want you to get the money. We're not saying give it away. But we want to make sure that the buyer agrees with you around what that value is, and that when you have some levers to engage in that sale, to ask for what it is, whether it's money or employees staying or legacy things, saying, you have some negotiating power by having done that work early.
Yeah. And talking about that work, the looking into values and figuring out what that qualitative aspect is to really unlock true value, which is being content on the other side of the deal and not being part of the 70% who are unhappy with that sale. Still an incredible statistic. How long do you recommend someone should start that process?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, you can get a sale done as quickly as 6 to 9 months, but it's not usually what you want to do. Mm. I would say that the shortest timeline that's going to make you happy is probably 1.5 years. The best timeline is at least 2 years. And part of that is delegating, right? My clients are literally superheroes, right? When we talk about that three circle model of family, business, ownership, they're right in the middle. They're like Atlas holding up the world. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't want to work for that new owner, or you're getting to the end of your career, we need to make sure you've delegated down those responsibilities. We need to make sure your team is staffed really well. I have lots of clients who have effective controllers, but no strategic CFO that can really help make this sale easier. And so the longer you have the time to put together, to build that bench strength, to spend time getting responsibilities out of your hand, and because most of my clients aren't sole owners, have the conversation with the family owners that aren't in the business about what this means for them. It just takes longer than you'd think.
Yeah. And I think there must be a bit of an identity crisis there too, because you don't have to be a business owner to have your identity attached to your career. But I imagine the magnitude of that is amplified greatly when either you have inherited a business or you have developed one from the ground up and you've brought it to the point of success where thinking about a strategic partnership or making acquisitions or exiting and selling, that really has to come knocking at the ego.
It does. You know, there's some fascinating statistics. The highest rate of divorce is the first 5 years in marriage, but the next highest rate is the first 2 years of exit of your own company, right? Wow. You're literally married to that business. A lot of men specifically, when they exit their company, also die of a heart attack within those first two years. Those that don't, when they exit, tend to have a long-term depression or some cognitive delay and decay because they've been using their brain cells and every ounce of their being running this company. And if you tell me your plan is golfing after, that never sticks.
Yeah. I was just about to ask, you know, the hobbyist who's like, no, I have hobbies and passions that I love and I want to spend more time doing them. That's not a strong strategy, is it?
It's not a plan. It doesn't work. You know, there's great resources like the Modern Elder Academy that Chip Connelly, I believe, wrote a book called The Making of the Modern Elder. And you can go there. There are some really good places that where you work on decks. Mm. I think it's called like Decks for Dudes, where you go and collaborate. This is where you want to join a board. And in fact, what we're finding in family companies and family offices, the legacy is entrepreneurship. You may start something else.
Right.
It might just not be this thing. But that plan needs to be made well in advance of it happening.
Yeah. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit because I'm pretty sure what I'm about to say was a statistic that I learned from you a handful of years ago about the fourth generation. It's not the second or third generation who most likely will revamp a business or re-engage a business, but the fourth generation tends to be the entrepreneurs, and they may actually start a business again or be the ones who come into the family business and zhuzh it up a little bit and get it going.
That's true. If you make it to the fourth generation, we usually see renewal there. And so at the end of the day, the question for sale is, are you ready? Can you get the maximum value for yourself, both in real values and dollars? And are you sure no one else is interested in coming in? Or are there ways that they can come in later? That's why we're seeing family businesses create family offices. You're keeping assets together that can eventually bring your family together. Can you turn that into a family bank? So each next generation person gets a loan to try out their new business. Are you able to start something that's more interesting to your grandchildren to do alongside of you? Mm-hmm. Are you then actually creating your own investment platform that's more interesting to them?
That's an important point to make as well, engaging the future generations in ways that is meaningful to them, which kind of brings us back full circle to finding what our purpose is and finding out what that is away from trying to prove ourselves.
Yeah, and finding it out, but also giving yourself the latitude to do something slightly different. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot in the family business field about, you know, the whole family planning. Until I said that statistic where people usually come back into the business at 45 or become successors at 45, you may be asking your kids when they don't know right now. And so this is where that person who's exiting the business, whether you're retiring or selling it, really gets to do your dream. Like, if you had your druthers, what would you do? And then you design it in a way that can invite other people there. It doesn't mean when they're ready, they can't make some changes to it. But if you're asking someone who's in their 20s, to tell you what they're going to do for the next 20 or 30 years, that conversation's going to fall. Yeah. And that's what I hear from a lot of founder entrepreneurs. Like, well, I asked them, and they said X, and then I went and did X, and they didn't want to do it. Well, they don't know yet.
Right.
So do what you want to do, and allow some on-ramps that they can join you.
And that can bake in some of those tumultuous moments that you were talking about at the top of our conversation, right? You're asking someone at a point in time in their life when they might not know. But if it's anchored to that, then resentment can build.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the founder entrepreneur to me is sometimes the smartest person in the room. There's some research that people over 55 actually are way smarter than other people. Wisdom is real. We're just a little slower at grabbing that information. So if you're saying, should I tell my kids who are 20, should my kids who are 20 tell me what to do when I'm the smartest person in the world, when I have this time availability? The answer is no. It's also not saying that you should constantly tell them what to do, but you should start with something and find ways that they can collaborate in joining you if that's something they want to do.
Yeah. And thinking out loud, like maybe even having a sense of appreciativeness to the younger generation for joining.
Absolutely. I think that's where these family banks, that's why we're seeing, you know, when I started doing this work years and years ago, we didn't talk about family offices. There weren't enough of them. But a family office allows people to shape the legacy. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, 5 to 8 values the family agrees on can be expressed in different ways. I had the privilege of working with a client that was in the lumber industry before our country was technically founded. That long ago. And then they were later in the railroad because of the lumber. And then they later got into cars. And then they later got into solar. And what they said the family legacy was getting people from one place to another. Mm. They didn't allow themselves to stay stuck in one thing. And so when you have a family office, it doesn't have to just be liquid capital that's being invested. It can have some other operating companies underneath it. And we can come around those bigger ideas. And that allows, you know, some of the main things people fight about are age, gender, all of these things that in a manufacturing company exist, right? Even if you let your daughters come into the company, when it's a largely male-dominated environment that maybe's cracking jokes that are male-dominated, right, wrong, or indifferent, it happens. They might not stay. And so this allows people to create some of their value together while still not saying, no, I don't want to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
But I want to do what you do, just differently.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit, 2 things I want to touch on. One, where are we today and what's happening? What are you seeing in the landscape going forward, given that we have had a pause in the M&A market? And B, deals that have fallen apart or there's been a meltdown when they've gotten close to the finish line for whatever reason, but perhaps an emotional one, a qualitative one versus a quantitative one. Because I think now is the time for people who did have deals fail a couple of years ago to reassess and be ready for their next opportunity if that's truly something that they want to do.
Absolutely. You know, where we are in the marketplace, deals have slowed down, but depending on the industry, they're still happening.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. You know, what a lot of buyers want now is even minority shareholders to sign on the dotted line, because they're the things that sometimes stop this. And so what a lot of family companies have done is ignore their minority shareholders for years. Mm. So when I talked about that longer time horizon, if you haven't talked to your, you know, B-stock shareholders about what actually is there, what this means for them, and help them along that journey, they may not sign on the dotted line. That's going to end your deal, likely. The other thing I see that's ending deals is we're a very large country, right? We're seven regions with seven distinct styles of conversation and assertiveness and aggressiveness and gregariousness, as well as bragginess. You know, mm-hmm. we're both New Yorkers. New York scores high on almost everything I mentioned. So when you have a deal with a Midwestern company and a Northeastern company, or a Southern company and a Northeastern company, what can happen during that, if we agree on the prices and we agree on the values, is we express those values differently, behaviorally. And what I've seen is some people back away from the table, assuming that the way you're expressing the value you both agreed on is actually different, right? If you say that we're kind, but you were braggy versus humble, you can still be kind doing those things. And so one of the things we encourage you to do is get your non-majority shareholders educated, informed early. Start engaging in the process. Help them know what's in it for them in the transaction. And along the way, with the prospective person that you're purchasing or being purchased by, really trying to focus on the content of what's being said and meet that and match that, not necessarily all the style that's coming up with that. And understand that it's a learning process. Everyone's just trying out ideas, and so no one's actually trying to add insult when they ask questions.
Right.
That was the most recent deal that I had with a client that almost fell apart, is the buyer was really inquisitive, incredibly inquisitive. And, you know, I do a lot of psychometric assessments, and I said, I think this person is really detail-oriented, and they're just trying to understand. And the woman who was selling the company, she sat back in her chair and she's like, I never thought about that. I thought he just thought he knew my business better than me. And I hadn't met the gentleman. I had just gleaned from her the way she was talking about it. So what she did is she took it as a compliment every time he started asking questions, realizing he was interested, and went with it. And the deal ended up going swimmingly.
Oh, that's so great, because that's the cultural aspect is important. A lot of people don't understand that there are cultural nuances. And they have not lived in other parts of the country. And maybe they only think about culture when they leave the country, not when they're in their own country. It's a wonderful thing to consider. And also, I think that we tend to, for whatever reason, make assumptions about what somebody's words mean. I love playing this icebreaker game. I did it just the other day with a group of 110 professionals who are advisors to business owners who are exiting. And I broke them off into little groups, and I told them I was going to give them a word association game. And the word that I gave them was win. And among seven groups, there was only one group that had one word in common. And I always find that such a fascinating game to play, because as advisors, professionals, business owners, you know, winning is something we all think we're striving towards every day, yet that word means something different every single human being.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're just saying what the truth is, whether it's talking about family or whether it's a sale to someone else. There are these differences that exist in life. That's the beauty of things. And unfortunately, we make those differences have meaning, especially in times where there's stress, like a sale, like a succession event. So your body is much more alert, and you might have, when you cared about that person, let it go, but in this moment, it's going to be really important, and you're going to get stuck on it.
Very needling. So if a word like win means something different, and it's not as emotionally charged as the word money, I can only imagine what happens.
Yeah, I love to tell this joke. You've heard it a million times, Diane, where I'm new to Brooklyn. I park in front of my house, and the sign says fine for parking, so I park there. Diane knows that fine is a monetary fee. She tells me not to park there. I say the sign says fine. We go home to our spouses, and we ask them how their day was. They respond with fine, and we know the day was terrible, right? It's a simple four-letter word, three different extreme meanings there. And that happens in language, even when we're speaking the same language, but especially when we're not.
How do we communicate in language?
Poorly. And poor communication breeds more miscommunication. You know, this research on bad listeners is bad listeners are historically bad listeners because they don't feel heard. And so when I have an executive tell me their spouse or their kids aren't listening to them, the first thing I say is, I don't think you've said it the way you think you have. It's really on us to try to make sure that that message has been received. And part of that is by bringing down our own needling, like you said, our own observing insult and injury when it's not there. What are the facts? If I had to take the affect out of what someone said, their tone of voice, the way they were breathing, all of that, in these three words, what did they literally mean? Not what am I interpreting them as?
Mm-hmm. We're wired for interpretation. I mean, it goes back to instinct and survival. We're here as a species because we reacted to things instinctually. We didn't ask that saber-toothed tiger what he meant.
Exactly.
We just ran.
Yeah, and we're doing it today, and our brain is 4 to 7 times more negative than positive. And so almost always that judgment you're making is negative and wrong.
Yeah. It's a constantly having to coach yourself and your internal dialogue. Very few people are aware of the need to do that. Very few people have the energy to do that day in and day out. Very few people have the capability to do it across an entire family.
Especially not in a family. You know, the unfortunate thing about where we believe we're safe, that's a marriage and a family, is we don't use our best skills. So, Diane, you and I enjoy each other because we're not sisters, right?
Oh, man.
We're bringing our best selves to each other because we're supposed to do that in work. And we're not doing that with our siblings, unfortunately, because that feels like work. And for a relationship to matter, even if you don't have the assets that our clients do, it's work.
Yeah.
And you've got to do it. The great thing about this work is it's front-loaded. It's harder at first, so when you're talking about your siblings, it's over 18. You've got to do a lot of work for a while. You do a little more when you're 35, but then it gets easy. The problem is we neglect to do the work because we don't think it's important. We don't care. It feels exhausting. And then when we're 55 or older, we're having these conversations, and it's a lot harder.
It applies to so many things. Even if you don't have a multi-generational family or a family business that's been around for many generations and is successful or acquiring other businesses, there are a lot of people who might go into the same profession together. There are siblings who may find themselves living close to each other. So it could be completely unrelated to actually owning a business or running a family office, but it's work that each of us needs to try to do.
It's true. A lot of my practice these days have been in PE firms and VC firms. Also, privately held companies that are best friends who started it, and people loved each other, and they didn't put the right documents together about what happens when we have a conflict because we love each other. But the longer we stay together, the less we listen, because our brains do this thing where it cares so much that it stops listening at the end of the day, because our brains are keeping us alive and there are more important things than listening to each other. That, like, same thing, there's a liquidity event coming and these are friends, not family, and they can't stand each other.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of stop listening, I'm sure we're coming towards the end of this. I want to ask you, are there any gems of advice or final pieces of information you would want to give to listeners?
The main one, to your point, Diane, is that we're a little bit our worst enemy. And so anytime anyone says anything, I would ask, what do I think they mean by that? And what's a generous assumption I can make about that? Like that client who almost lost this deal that was really great. She got 9x for her business. And she just said he asked too many questions. He thought he didn't care about it. And I had to say, what did he say that said he didn't like the business? And she sat back and she's like, nothing. There was never a question that didn't end with a question, right? So it's first, what do you think they could have meant by that? And what's a generous assumption I could give that they're trying to get that information? And if you can do it without looking like a person who's unwell, I would do it aloud. So your brain actually hears it as a real question and you speak it as truth. And that's the start of it.
Speak it as truth.
Yeah.
I think I just found the title for this episode. Thank you very much. Well, as many of the listeners know, I am Diane Johnston, and I am a financial advisor and institutional consultant with UBS Financial Services. As I mentioned during this recording, Natalie is a friend and also an external business colleague that I enjoy using. If you have any questions for her or for me, feel free to give me a call or send me an email, 516-745-8964 or diane.johnston@ubs.com. Natalie, is it fair to say that if there were a family business or family office out there that wanted to have an informational call with you, you'd be happy to do that?
Absolutely. Anything for you, Diane.
Oh, you're awesome. Thank you so much for being here today. I really enjoyed this.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business, that they carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to them about the products or services we offer. For more information, visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA SIPC.